Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fourth hour of Ira David Wood III's Confessions of an Elf. We'll begin with about a 10-minute break here, so everybody gets a chance to get up and get away. And we'll be playing some music by Robin Bullock from the CD, A Guitar for Christmas. At the end of this show, there's still going to be some extra time, so I'm going to be filling in with some personal narratives from a few of the readers here, and probably going to have room for one more. I'm going to call it Random Christmas Story. So come on back in about 8 or 9 minutes, and we'll pick up on the final installment of Confessions of an Elf.
Thank you. The realness of Santa Claus. The little world of childhood with its familiar surroundings is a model of the greater world. The more intensively the family has stamped its character upon the child, the more it will tend to feel and see its earlier miniature world again in the bigger world of adult life. Carl Gustav Jung. Everyone believes in something, even if it's only the assumption that there's nothing at all left to believe in. But even that's still belief in something, and it's better than nothing, though not by much. In other words, there's always something to believe in. It's merely a question of choice. A little girl named Virginia O'Hanlon once wrote Frances P. Church a letter in which she stated that her friends were telling her there was no such thing as Santa Claus. She wanted to know if that was true or not. After giving it a bit of thought, Church decided to set the record straight. His reply to Virginia was also a priceless gift to the rest of the world, a wonderful defense regarding the realness of Santa Claus that has since become history's most reprinted newspaper editorial. In fact, it is such a brilliant defense, it deserves to be reprinted here. If it's been a while since you've read it in its entirety, it'll certainly be worth the time it may take to refresh your memory. Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except what they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas! How dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus. You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in this world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernal beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world there's nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus. Thank God he lives. He lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood. During all the time I've worked for and been associated with the boss, I've never once heard him try to convince a single soul that he's real. And take it from one who knows. He's been in belief situations that would try the patience of saint. If he had a quarter for every time some little perched on his lap in a department store asked him if he was real, he'd be a very wealthy person today. It's always puzzled me, too, why any little, perched on Santa's knee and running sticky, candy-coated fingers through his beard, would stop to wonder if it were a real person's knee and a real person's beard. Littles must be very confused about reality sometimes, but then they do live in a very confused and confusing world. Biggles have had a hard enough time trying to make sense of things, constantly wandering around asking themselves, is this really the way I feel, or is this honestly what I want? In other words, they spend a great deal of time second-guessing what's real and what's merely an impression of reality. And to that, the preconceived notion, hammered into their consciousness since birth, that they should be doing what everybody else is doing, and you can see why adult stress levels are at all-time highs. No wonder littles pick up the doubting habit so early in life. No wonder they need a little occasional reassurance while sitting on Santa's knee. In a very beautiful play by Piugli Pirandello, one of his characters says, "I only know that when I was a child, I thought the moon in the pond was real. How many things I thought real? I believed everything I was told, and I was happy." When you go to a movie or play, you're requested to suspend your disbelief, at least to a degree. Suspending disbelief for a few hours is the way you commit to the special magic of any theatrical production. You know, for instance, the character of Don Quixote in The Man of La Mancha is being played by an actor. You know he doesn't actually die during the last act of the show while singing The Impossible Dream. But if you're able to suspend enough of your disbelief, you will sit there in your seat and weep at it all. Some theatergoers can suspend enough disbelief to enjoy a veritable emotional smorgasbord. The practice of suspending your disbelief is a nice habit whether you attend the theater or not. Entrepreneurs do it all the time. Remember, there was a time when people believed no one could fly. The thought that man could fly was an illusion. The Wright brothers simply suspended their disbelief in what appeared to be an illusion. The next thing they suspended was the motor-driven airplane, in midair. So you see what can happen when you start committing to the possibilities. We spend a large portion of our lives developing beliefs. These beliefs are grounded in experience and, more often than not, serve us well. But occasionally we can take one or two of those beliefs and, while focusing on them alone, try suspending our associated disbelief. Do you think it was easy for the first flying reindeer to take that initial death-defying leap of faith? Au contraire. Let me assure you that for the first 500 feet of the free fall, there was an incredible amount of deer screaming, followed, of course, by a growing sense of self-assurance coupled with a brazen display of mind-blowing aerial acrobatics. The point here is that whenever we're brave enough to put our beliefs to a test, whole new horizons begin to open up. We tend to begin to look at things as being possible instead of always impossible. At the very least, chances are better that we won't disregard the possibility of something else just because it doesn't seem to exist within the realm of the currently accepted belief. The comfortable thing about this approach to life is that it's positive. It's also a sure guarantee that as long as we can accept possibilities, we'll also never cease to explore, learn, and grow. This brings us back to the topic at hand, the realness of Santa Claus. It's a belief that most people are going to examine at some point in their lives. In fact, it's one of the very first belief struggles you'll probably get into, a special struggle because it's something that's often done in private. It generally begins when a little hears someone say, "There's no such thing as Santa Claus." The little who hears this for the first time usually has a very logical response. "Are you crazy? I've sat on his knee and pulled his beard." "Oh, sure," the argument goes, "but that wasn't the real Santa Claus." Following that sort of logic, a lot of people's hair isn't real either. Why? Because a lot of people have hair that is no longer its natural color. So, because the color isn't natural, the aforementioned logic would have us believe that the hair isn't real either. Well, folks, if color-treated hair isn't real hair, we got an awful lot of bald-headed people walking the streets, and somebody better get them this vital information in a hurry. Okay. Now for a little ORC, obvious religious connotation. I said we'd stay away from it as long as possible, and I've kept my word, but there's just no way around the obvious point that no one has seen God either. Even Moses had to talk to a burning bush. Can you blame the children of Israel for going a little berserk when he came down from the mountain carrying the Ten Commandments? With all due respect to Charlton Heston, I don't believe Moses really made such a grand entrance into the midst of the Hebrew children, who, by the way, had decided to party down with the golden idol in his absence. "Hold on," Moses says. "What you're doing is all wrong." "Oh, yeah," comes the reply. "Says who?" "God says so," Moses informs them. "Yeah," continues the retort. "You saw God up on that mountain?" "As a matter of fact," Moses concludes, "I did." Now, Moses had to be grimacing when he said that because he knew the obvious comeback was going to be finally getting around to, "What did God look like?" Can you imagine the expression on their faces when Moses told them God was a burning bush? They probably stood around in absolute silence for a few minutes, just waiting for the punchline. Here's this man, standing at the foot of a mountain with 10 rules carved into stone tablets. 10 rules the entire world should live by. Rules he got straight from a burning bush. And some people have a hard time trying to understand why the children of Israel may have thought Moses was just a bubble or two off plumb. The obvious point here is that just because God appeared in the form of a burning bush doesn't mean God is a bush. The spirit of Christmas may choose to appear in the form of Santa Claus. That doesn't mean that the spirit of Christmas is Santa Claus, but the spirit of Christmas can take the form of Santa Claus, just like God can take the form of a burning bush. Look at it from another point of view. Can you sit on the knee of a spirit and tell it what you want for Christmas? In a very real way, you can. You have. Seen any burning bushes lately? I don't know. But have you ever noticed how a Christmas tree can appear to blaze with light? Might a Christmas tree even be considered a burning bush of sorts? Up to you, but remember that your job is to try to consider the possibilities. And speaking of trees, lights, and possibilities, decorating Christmas trees began in Germany as far back as the 10th century. It's generally believed that Martin Luther was the one who started it all. The story goes that he was out walking one beautiful Christmas Eve. The night sky was wondrously clear and lit by millions of twinkling stars. The sight so moved Martin Luther that he uprooted a small fir tree and took it back home with him. There he fixed little wax candles to the branches of the tree and lit them. This was done to remind children of the beautiful heavens from which Christ descended to save the world. By 1604, the idea had taken hold, and decorating fir trees was a fairly common practice. According to Charles Greville, a 19th-century diarist, the first Christmas tree in England was put up by a German Princess Leven. Most Englishmen will tell you that Prince Albert was the one who introduced the Christmas tree to England, but he was actually 10 years behind Princess Leven. What Prince Albert did do, along with Queen Victoria, of course, was popularize the custom of having the Christmas tree become the central feature of the family Christmas. Victoria wrote that the custom of decorating a fir tree, together with sounds of trumpets heralding in the new year, quite affected dear Albert, who turned pale and had tears in his eyes and pressed my hand very warmly. In 1841, she also noted, "Today I have 2 children of my own to give presents to, who, they know not why, are full of happy wonder at the German Christmas tree and its radiant candles." Do you know who had the very first Christmas tree decorated with electric lights? Thomas Edison. Who else? In 1882, only 3 years after he had given the world his invention of the light bulb, Edison's co-workers hand-blew tiny bulbs and wired them to a tree as a surprise for him. Still, it wasn't until 1903 that the idea really caught on and the very first strings of electric Christmas tree lights were sold by General Electric. Before that, John Barth, a German Methodist minister in Louisville, Kentucky, had come up with the idea of decorating Christmas trees with tiny oil lamps. Instead of the exposed flame of a candle, the flames produced by Barth's tiny oil lamps were protected by a little glass globe. Barth got his patent in 1887. After the custom of decorating Christmas trees caught on, what happened next? 2 Philadelphians, Herman Albrecht and Abram Mott, received the first U.S. patents for Christmas tree stands. That was in 1876. The first electric revolving tree stand was patented by Alfred Wagner of St. Louis in 1899. The oldest known reference to Christmas trees in America comes from the same people who passed out the first Christmas presents in the New World, the Moravians. On Christmas Day, 1747, in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, there were several small pyramids and one large pyramid of green brushwood, all decorated with candles and the large one with apples and pretty verses. Incredible, isn't it? What started out as a gentle and beautiful reminder to the children of the world didn't waste any time in becoming an incredibly large and mechanized industry. Christmas tree lots spring up like mushrooms before the Thanksgiving dishes have even been washed and put away. Most people don't know where the custom of decorating trees came from or why. To be honest, most people don't really care. All most people know is that they'd better rush out and buy one of the darn things while the pickings are good. There are so many things about the celebration of Christmas that were put in place to be reminders to us. The sad thing about all of it is that we've somehow forgotten what it was we were supposed to remember. We have Christmas trees, mistletoe, wassail toasts, and Yule logs. We just don't know what they symbolize or used to symbolize, and why that symbolism is even more important anymore. The same thing is becoming true about the symbol of Santa Claus. A lot of people say the legend surrounding Santa Claus first began with a man known as Saint Nicholas. Other than that, there isn't very much more we know about this man, except that he was born in Lycia, now part of Turkey, lived there all his life, became its archbishop, and died there sometime in the first part of the 4th century AD. What we do know about St. Nicholas is that he became one of the most popular saints of the Middle Ages. In fact, he was so popular that he was adopted as a patron saint by pawnbrokers, brewers, pilgrims, parish clerks, coopers, travelers, boatmen, Aberdeen, Russia, and those who had unjustly lost lawsuits. but we primarily remember him as being the patron saint of children. St. Nicholas's feast day was traditionally celebrated on December 6th, when children were presented gifts of gingerbread and toys. Are you beginning to see how it's all evolved through the years? To make things easier to grasp, you've got to understand one thing. Santa Claus has a lot of helpers, thousands upon thousands of them. Some of them only chip in around Christmas time. Others work it all year long. Some are very good at what they do. Others, well, at least they give it a shot and hang on to their day jobs. Since there are thousands upon thousands of helpers and only one real Santa Claus, chances are that you're going to run into a helper more often than you're going to bump into the real McCoy. It's just the law of averages. Put it another way, the world is also full of bushes. God chose only one of them to appear in Formosus. It's the same principle with Santa's helpers. Every now and then, one of them gets chosen. The thing is, you never know which one. And don't always think you're going to better your chances by looking only in the nicest, most expensive places. Here again, it's well to remember that God didn't choose a giant redwood. He chose a little bush. Consider a few more points. Was God any less real for choosing to appear as a burning bush? Is the spirit of Christmas any less real for choosing to sometimes appear as a jolly old fat man in a red suit? It's true that a few people might get the impression that God is only a burning bush, just like some people believe that the spirit of Christmas is only Santa Claus. This happens because people are limited only by their imaginations, and some people's imaginations are only limited. We tend to refer to these kinds of people as being extremely literal. They can deal wonderfully with spreadsheets, but have a very tough time with original ideas. They live in a tangible realm of literal existence. If they can't touch it, taste it, smell it, or hear it, and preferably all at the same time, then it's just not real to them. Well, Santa Claus is, more often than not, a very tangible presence around the Christmas time. If you're heavy into the literal realm of existence, then Santa's just about it as far as December 25th is concerned. You've probably heard a lot about London's Big Ben. It's a clock, right? One of the most famous clocks in the whole world, right? Wrong. Big Ben is not a clock. It's a bell, located in the clock tower of the House of Parliament. It's been there since 1859, long enough for people to become a bit confused. For years, every time Big Ben chimed, people looked toward the direction of the sound. What did they see? A clock. So naturally, they began to associate the name of the bell they heard to the sight they saw. Never mind that Big Ben is a bell. A 13-ton bell, at that, 9 feet in diameter and 7.5 feet tall. As far as most people are concerned, it's a clock. The perception has become the reality, a reality that happens to be based on an incorrect assumption. So if you look at Christmas and all you see is Santa Claus, or one of his helpers, you're seeing only part of the picture. You're seeing what the spirit of Christmas has become for some people. In other words, you're looking at a bell and calling it a clock. And if the Santa Claus you're looking at doesn't happen to fulfill all your expectations, it's easy to say he isn't real. And maybe that particular Santa Claus isn't. I mean, I know one rotten apple can spoil a whole barrel, but to say Santa Claus doesn't exist, period, is a rather sweeping statement to make based on one minor disappointment. The truth is that it really doesn't matter if you don't believe in Santa Claus. The most important thing to know is that he believes in you. Unfortunately, there's some people who've managed to convince themselves that they don't need Santa Claus to be real. Don't ask me why, just accept the fact. And for these people, the unbelievers, Santa Claus doesn't exist. These are the same people who hear Big Ben chiming away, glance up at the clock, and then say, "I didn't hear that. Did you?" But it's their reality, and they're certainly permitted to have one. A few people once became so concerned about how Santa Claus was being perceived that a group of them even formed the Santa Claus Association in New York during 1914 in order to, quote, preserve children's faith, end quote. This association took upon itself the task of answering all mail marked to Santa Claus, which was handed over to them by the post office. We got a big kick out of it back at the North Pole. We really did. When you get right down to it, it's a lot easier not to believe in Santa Claus. If you don't believe in him, you don't have to define him for yourself. You don't have to decide a lot of things, either. You don't have to worry about how he gets to every single house to deliver his toys in one single night. Actually, it's not such a problem. In Germany, for instance, St. Nicholas comes on December 6th, so not everything has to be done in just one night. If you don't believe in Santa Claus, you also don't have to worry about how reindeers fly. But did you know that a hummingbird can hover in place, fly straight up or down, and even backward? One South American species even has a wing beat of up to 4,800 strokes a minute. No big deal, you say? It wouldn't be if it wasn't supposed to be impossible for the bird to be able to do it. Trouble is, nobody ever bothered to tell the hummingbird that what it was doing was impossible. So it just flies. There may be thousands of people who say reindeer can't fly either. The trouble is, nobody ever bothered to explain the principles of flight to Dasher, Dancer, and Prancer. So they have absolutely no reason to believe they can fly. And sometimes what you don't know can be a very big advantage. Point is, if you don't believe in Santa Claus, you don't have to worry about having one more Christmas thing to worry about. On the other hand, you might consider the fact that you're also missing one of the most special advantages of being young, the joy of freely and unabashedly suspending your disbelief. You may as well. There's precious little encouragement to do it later on. Some bagels have to actually live in a world where the Pennsylvania Dutch aren't Dutch, they're German. Bedstraw isn't straw. It's really an herb that grows wild in the woods and marshes. Catgut strings aren't made from catgut, but from sheep intestines. Shooting stars aren't stars. They're meteors or meteoroids. And old Ironsides didn't have Ironsides at all. Its sides were made of wood. It's enough to send even a literal person right over the edge. A world like that can make suspending your disbelief feel about the same as doing endless bench presses with very heavy weights. People's bodies change when they grow. Why not their dreams, their beliefs? To say that things mature sounds very nice, but an awful lot of stagnation can hide behind the word maturity. To say our dreams and beliefs mature doesn't necessarily mean they have to lose any of their vitality or magic. Do you know what real maturity is, anyway? Real maturity is finally getting to that place in life where you're truly ready to begin to learn. And somebody please explain to me why you humans have come to equate adulthood with the loss of your sense of wonder. What does it mean when someone tells you to act your age? If experience has taught us anything, it's that the more we learn, the more there is to learn. The more we love, the more there is left to love. And the more we know, the greater is our sense of wonder at it all. And that wonderment isn't something you should keep to yourself. Shared wonder is one of the greatest joys there is. Life is not a mission you're sent on with sealed orders to be opened only when you've finally made it to your destination. And Santa Claus doesn't die just because we cease to believe in him. The truth is that we are the ones who are diminished by our lack of faith. Dag Hammarskjöld once said the same thing about God. Your sense of wonder is always with you. So is God. And don't you love it when the people say you have to put God back in your life, or put God back into public schools, put God here, put God there? You don't put God anywhere. You can't. Besides, God never left. Go and see for yourself if you don't believe me. God's here. God's much closer than you think. Find him again, and dust off your sense of wonder while you're at it. Because if you come close to finding God, you're going to need it. When you get right down to it, there's not very much wrong with occasionally having visions of sugar plums dancing in your head. And perhaps, from time to time, we all need to believe the moon in the pond is real. All we're really doing is considering the possibilities. Besides, if Santa Claus isn't real, only the literal world is. Like I said, it's all up to you.
A lesson from the lilies. Remember that the most beautiful things in the world are the most useless. Peacocks and lilies, for instance. John Ruskin. If the whole world, south of the North Pole, was suddenly transformed into a single town with 100 people living in it, 50 of those people would be hungry most of the time. Only 15 people in that town would be living in adequate housing. Only one of those 100 people would have a college education. 5 of the town's senior citizens would be victims of constant physical abuse. 6 people out of the 100 would control almost half the wealth of the entire town, and of those 6, 3 would be Americans. On the surface, things might not appear too rosy for this place. Obviously, there's some perilous inequality manifesting itself around almost every corner. 50 people going hungry and 85 people without adequate housing can take a serious bite out of human dignity. And if history has shown us anything, it's that people eventually are going to demand to get back a sense of human dignity. It may take a while because people can endure a great deal of suffering, degradation, and inequality. That's because God made people strong. But even strength has its limits, and compromise eventually becomes unjustifiable. When that time comes, those 50 hungry people, those 85 people living in inadequate housing, are going to begin to take a good look around. The first place they're going to look at is in the general direction of those 6 people who seem to have everything. The assumption is that if everyone shared equally in everything, there wouldn't be a problem. No one would be greater or lesser than their neighbor. Equal distribution of the wealth would mean there would be food and housing for all, right? Well, that concept may seem logical on a spreadsheet, but the reality doesn't always balance out quite so nicely. Just ask Lenin. Let's concentrate for a moment on those 6 people who control most of the wealth in this town. More specifically, let's focus on the 3 Americans in that group. At least 2 out of those 3 Americans are going to tell you they are where they are because of divine right. If for no other reason, they were born Americans, so they've earned it. America's Declaration of Independence talks about all of you being created equal. This, however, is what's known as Catch-22. All of you may be created equal, it's just that you don't tend to stay equal, at least not for very long. The poet Robert Frost once said, "The world is full of willing people, a few willing to work, the rest willing to let them." And you can bet your last nickel that those 3 Americans have that verse embroidered on a plush velvet cushion somewhere in their living rooms. Americans are very clear on one fundamental truth. They have earned whatever it is they have. They earn merit badges and college diplomas. They earn battle wounds and 2-week vacations. They earn gold medals and gray hairs. Parents have earned the right to tell their children about how they had to walk 5 miles to school in the snow, uphill, both ways. You earn the right to drive a car. The right to vote in free elections was earned for you. You simply earned the right to keep the privilege. A middle-aged man suddenly lets his sideburns grow long, buys a sports car, divorces his wife of 30 years, and starts going out with a woman half his age. Why? Because he's earned it. Of course, his wife takes him to court and ends up with half of everything he owns. Why? She's earned it, too. And this word earned is always said with a great deal of pride, no matter what the circumstances. And the admonition to go out and earn something for yourself is passed from one person to the next, from one generation to another, like sage advice. You want something in this world, kid? Get out there and earn it. It's just that. Sometimes that advice gets a slight Marie Antoinette tinge to it. Now, I'm sure Marie Antoinette didn't say, "Let them eat cake," because she was absolutely heartless. She probably thought she was actually being very kind to the starving peasants. If there was no bread, they certainly earned the right to eat a little cake. Unfortunately, by the time she made that gracious offer, cake was the last thing the peasants wanted to hear about. They'd already gotten a whiff of the filet mignon. It's just that this earning thing is double-edged. By that I mean it doesn't just apply to only the things you want to earn. We also, and to a great degree, earn our wars, slums, poverty, illiteracy, and spiritual starvation, to name only a few. You spoke too many cigarettes, you'll probably earn yourself a nice case of lung cancer. Works both ways. I guess it all boils down to what you do with what you earn that makes a big difference. Santa Claus and his wife don't have any children of their own, so he simply adopted the children of the world. He earned their love, and yes, even their occasional doubts about him as well. That double edge again. It's all part of the territory, the good, the bad, the yin and yang, the ebb and flow of everything. So these 6 people in this town of 100 have 2 choices. Either they sit on their cushions embroidered with Robert Frost's verse on willingness, or they do what they can with what they have to try and make a difference. If cake is all they have to work with, let's just hope they understand that timing is everything. Did you know that Americans give away about $125 billion to charities every year? Well, they do, but before you sit back in the comfortable belief that all Americans are wonderfully generous people, you need to understand a few things about the above figure. The majority of that $125 billion comes from households with incomes well below $10,000 a year. America's poorest households give more than 5% of their hard-earned and meager means to charity, even though these gifts obviously involve some degree of sacrifice. On the other hand, the wealthiest Americans with incomes above $100,000 a year give less than 3%. These figures are troubling when you consider the fact that one of the cornerstones of the holiday season has always been the spirit of giving. Once during each year, everyone is expected to freely open their hearts and share. The truth is, given the prevailing mood, this simple annual act of unselfishness is becoming harder and harder to realize. Here's what I mean. In 1979, people making $1 million gave more than 7% of their after-tax income to charity. 12 years later, that figure had dropped to less than 4%. Not long ago, 8 of 10 Americans who had estates of $500,000 or more left absolutely nothing at all to charity. Who knows? Maybe somebody out there finally found a way to take it with them. And to all of you who annually fret and worry over itemizing deductions on your tax return, take heart, because heart is obviously something you all have lots of. This is evidence in the fact that all taxpayers who itemize deductions, charitable contributions increased by an average of some 9% during the past decade. Again, on the other hand, for those with pre-tax incomes over $1 million, contributions decreased by nearly 40%. If peace on earth is something you want, then you truly need to get about the business of earning it. After all, it almost comes one night out of every year without anyone trying very hard at all. Imagine what might happen if people worked on it every day during the rest of the year. And goodwill towards men is going to take some serious concentration, too. That's something you earn and keep earning all your life. If the world is going to continue to be filled with haves and have-nots, then we've got to be careful about becoming complacent about the prevailing situation. Both sides have got to try to make things better than they are. And the first thing everybody's going to need is a healthy share of human dignity. Because without human dignity, there's no sense of self-worth. Without self-worth, nobody's going to give a flip about changing anything. You know the old saying, apathy's our greatest problem, but who cares? Do you know who cares in America? Statistics tell us that 100 million people do. That's right. 100 million people are out there waiting to volunteer their time and energy to make the world a better place. To volunteer, mind you, do it for free. Know what they're waiting for? A leader. Someone to give them a unified direction. Someone to say, okay, let's do it. Know where you find that leader? Looked in the mirror lately? I'm serious. Never mind that you don't think you fit the image. Gandhi wasn't exactly what you call pinup material, but he sure made one incredible difference. History books are full of stories about people who changed things, people who, to see them at first glance, didn't exactly appear to be very likely candidates for the job. I mean, for instance, if you were writing down a list of prerequisites for becoming a leader, do you really think one of them would be that you should have a round little belly that shook when you laughed like a bowl of jelly? I don't think so, but it's worked extremely well for the boss. Another example of taking what you have and doing something with it. And before you finish stereotyping the role completely, you might also remember that a very wise book reminds us that a child shall lead the way. In other words, littles have as much of an opportunity to make a difference in the world as biggles. Remember that we're going to try to consider and remain open to all of the possibilities. You never know what size or shape your next leader is going to appear to you in. So stay alert. Don't preconceive. You don't want to be the one who misses the parade. And whatever happens, whatever changes you're going to make, need to be made by all of us working together. Ever heard the word synergy? People seem to be using it a lot these days. Basically, synergy means that considering the lilies of the field isn't such a bad idea. If you plant two plants next to each other, their roots will naturally commingle. The direct result of this commingling is that the soil improves. The two plants grow better than if they were separated. Thank you, Mother Nature. The real essence of synergy is that it values differences. It uses differences in an atmosphere of creative cooperation and mutual benefit. Plants are only one larger part of natural cycle of life support. If plants thrive, the soil improves. When that happens, other living things benefit. Eventually, the entire planet is able to rejuvenate itself, all because two small plants started working together. Hello! There's a fundamental lesson here. It starts somewhere, then someone starts with you. Take a lesson from the lilies. All of us put our roots down sooner or later. We've got to take something from the soil in order to exist. Likewise, we've got to begin to put something back in the process. Otherwise, sooner or later, the soil becomes depleted, and a depleted life support system can't possibly nurture new growth, let alone sustain what's already there. Americans understood this axiom when they founded their country. How'd they put it? United we stand, divided we fall. The founding father who first came up with that slogan obviously had a few lilies growing in his garden. Differences can do one of two things. They can keep us separated or bring us together. I'm an elf, you're a human. The differences are obvious. Yet we probably have more things in common than you might realize. Oh, sure, there will always be one or two elves that might say, I like people well enough, it's just I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. And as long as you're a plant, who can select what part of the garden you're going to grow in? That sort of thinking will carry you for a certain distance and no farther. For a bunch of lilies does not necessarily a garden make. Unless, of course, you're only interested in lily gardens. And lily gardens are quite beautiful. It's just that usually gardens contain varieties of things, herbs and plants of different kinds, shapes, sizes, and colors. And each plant, aside from its own intrinsic beauty and uniqueness, has a special contribution to make to the overall life support system, the total environment. Synergy. What a wonderful legacy to leave for future generations, an environment that not only allows, but nurtures a true fulfillment of self-worth, a world that has matured into independence by finally embracing the value and necessity of interdependence. Not a bad place to call home, not a bad place at all. There used to be a wonderful ceremonial Christmas drink in Old England called lamb's wool. It was a marvelous mixture of hot ale, sugar, spices, eggs, and roasted apples. Sometimes thick cream was also added to this mixture. It was traditionally served in a wassail bowl with pieces of toast floating on top. This is where the term toasting someone or making a toast originated. The term wassail comes from the Anglo-Saxon west hive, which is another way of saying be whole. If someone said wassail to you, it was customary to reply, drink hail. That was like saying to your health. I especially like the literal meaning of wassail, be whole. Think about that. If there has ever been a blessing worth sharing or a toast worth making, the literal meaning of this word is certainly one of them. Be whole. What a marvelous challenge to take with us throughout the rest of the year. Well, it's about time for us to leave our town of 100 people. As a matter of fact, it's about time for me to leave you. However, as long as this is a town of our own imaginings, we really ought to leave it with something. And I say, let's leave them with Christmas. Doesn't matter what month of the year it is, we can still leave them with a sense of Christmas in their hearts. Whether you are a believer or a non-believer, you still have to admit, for at least one night out of every year, something magical does happen to the world. You can't help but feel it in the air. You can surely see it in the eyes of your children. So we should certainly want to leave our town of 100 people a bit more in tune with the little inside of each of them. We can leave them with hope, and perhaps a renewed sense of awareness. We can leave them with a certain amount of positive excitement about the future. We should remind them of one of life's greatest truths, that the key to happiness and contentment comes from within. We can leave them with something to put back into the soil of their gardens, something that nurtures the earth. And who knows, maybe those three Americans who own most of the wealth in that town will hook up with the other three who own the rest, and maybe, just maybe, those six very wealthy people will find themselves huddled together under some lamppost this year, singing Christmas carols to absolute strangers, or stopping by a soup kitchen to roll up their sleeves and pitch in. We can leave them with the possibility of what can happen once they start using what they have to make the world a better place. And you know what? That's a very nice place to leave you too. Wassail, my friends, be whole.
That's it for Ira David Wood's book, Confessions of an Elf. Once again, we want to extend our thanks to Ira David Wood III for allowing us to broadcast his book. Also want to extend our thanks to Robin Bullock for letting us use music from his CD, Guitar for Christmas. I want to mention my readers real quick here. Special thanks to Pamela Vesper, Joanna Harith, Josh Harris, and Blair Jerome. We're going to listen to the rest of this song, O Little Town of Bethlehem, and then I'm going to come back with three personal narratives, very short ones, from some of the readers here.
I'm Sharon Silcox, and my story is Pink Angels. I am a child of the 50s and 60s. We were a typical family. Dad worked, Mom stayed home, and my younger sister and I went to school. We had two crazy, affectionate dachshunds named Fritz and Greta. Our home was in Roanoke, Virginia, a valley in the Blue Ridge Mountains. There were many strengths in these typical families. One of the strengths of my home was the Pink Angels. I was in elementary school in the 60s. Every year, on a day in early December, I would open the front door after walking home from school and, oh, it would be Pink Angel Day. Mom would have all sizes of old cardboard boxes down from the attic. Each contained Christmas magic. After dropping my books and tossing my winter coat and sweater somewhere near the closet, I would watch her as she gently lifted two beautiful, glorious pink-feathered angels out of their nest of last year's newspapers. I knew my mother loved these angels. She took such care fluffing out their feathers and dusting the porcelain heads that had white ponytailed hair and a gold bow painted on the top. White pipe cleaner arms held silvery songbooks. Their red rosebud mouths were open in what I imagined was happy caroling. She placed them on glass-spun white angel hair on the top of a cabinet under a window. I always begged to be allowed to perform this ritual, and one year she let me. First, I dusted the cabinet with paper towels and pledge. Next, I arranged the angel hair and finally lifted the angels to their place under the window. They glowed under the light of the dying day, and I felt proud, knowing I had created something beautiful for my family. My eyes always searched for the angels first when I opened the front door home from school. Somehow, I knew how important they were to us, a bond we four shared, expressing our joy in Christmas and in each other. Oh, we didn't always get along. Who does? But these pink angels represented the best in each of us to each other, a repetition and a renewal every year. I don't remember packing the angels back in their box. Perhaps my mother did. It was her job to protect my dreams and joy, cradle the fragile feathers in this year's newspapers. The papers gradually became last year's papers, and the angels would emerge again, fresh and beautiful in my eyes, and now my heart's memory.
Hover, and my story is called The Refrigerator. This is a story about how my grandmother got her new refrigerator. Times were hard in the 1930s. Money was so scarce that the men in the family, my grandfather and his two sons, took turns wearing the only dress suit they owned. This could get complicated if both boys had a big date on the same night. Hominy was an inexpensive staple at most meals, and there were few labor-saving electric appliances to be had. My grandmother had an old-fashioned refrigerator that kept food from spoiling with a big block of ice. It was inconvenient because the drip pan had to be emptied often, and the ice man needed to make deliveries on a regular basis. My grandfather owned General Auto Supply, which furnished car parts and also did repairs on cars when needed. Back then, cars were mechanical, so you couldn't just plug into a computer for a diagnosis. You could actually fix one yourself if you had the parts and the knowledge. Some cars weren't all that reliable, and it wasn't unusual to have replaced an entire engine. All these repairs resulted in many mashed fingers, skinned knuckles, and lots of colorful language. There were several customers in particular who could cause quite a bit of blue air. After several extremely aggravating days in a row, my grandfather decided that there should be a ban on the use of foul language. This turned out to be an impossible task, so he put a bounty on swear words. Each one would cost the offender a whopping 25 cents. And the cuss box was created. This was during a time when $10 or $15 a week was considered a living wage. The money in the cuss box grew at a remarkable rate, so that by the time the holidays came near, there was close to $90, and a plot was hatched to surprise my grandmother with an electric refrigerator. So on that fateful day, while she was in the grocery store, the guy snuck the refrigerator into the house. I'll spare you the details, but it involved a steep flight of stairs onto the back porch, and they had it up and running when she got home. I can't help wondering if my grandfather put a moratorium on the cussing ban just until they got the fridge in place. When she walked through the door, my grandmother was so startled to see an electric refrigerator in her kitchen, she dropped the grocery bag she was carrying, and oranges brought for the Christmas stocking went rolling across the floor. Needless to say, she was thrilled not only that she received this wonderful gift, but more importantly, was awed by the effort it took her family to acquire it and the love it represented. She enjoyed it for many, many years. Rumor has it that hers was the first electric refrigerator in the whole neighborhood. And in 2008, when her house was closed up for the final time, the refrigerator went with my sister, and as far as I know, it's still being used.
Once again, I'm Kurt Benrud with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. You've been listening to Ira David Wood III's Confessions of an Elf. I want to thank once again my readers, Pam, Joanna, Josh, and Blair. Thanks to David once again, and thanks to Robin Bullock for the music from Guitar for Christmas. Merry Christmas, everybody.